I welcome you to the second, third hour. Our guest these 2 hours today is David McGowan. He is the author of Derailing Democracy, the America the Media Don't Want You to See. He also wrote Understanding the F Word and Programmed to Kill, The Politics of Serial Murder. His latest book is Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, the Laurel Canyon Covert Ops and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. It's available in Kindle or paperback at Amazon. Dave, welcome to the program. Is Dave there? Okay, Dave, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. And you?
I'm, alive and well. I was getting a little worried that you, the phone hadn't rung yet. I thought it was getting a little late.
But, Well, we have, six minutes of commercials and public service announcements and that kind of thing. So, well, I'm always glad to talk to you. You're always so very interesting. And your books are wonderful. I remember, you know, how you remember when you, where you were at 9/11. You remember all these things. I know exactly where I was when I read Democracy, the America the Media Don't Want You to See. I read the entire book at the gym.
That's quite an honor, I must say. Wow. I'm speechless. How long, when was the last time I was on? I was on since the most recent book came out.
Oh, yes. It was just about to, I believe you were. But, or it was just about to be out, but it was, I'll look it up.
Everything has just been a blur since then. I cannot believe how insanely busy I've been and, how many interviews I've done, personal appearances, and I've been contacted by Hollywood agents, and I've had three inquiries about film and TV rights, acquiring film and TV rights, which I am highly skeptical of, to say the least, that anything will ever come from them, and you know, people have warned me about people possibly attempting to buy up the rights, not with the purpose of developing them, but with the purpose of burying it to make sure that nobody else, you know, can develop it. But yeah, it's just been absolutely insane. I mean, the book's been out for, I think, 5 months now. It came out April 30th, so it's been out May, June, July, August, September. Yeah, 5 months. And it's just been an absolutely insane whirlwind of activity. I can't believe how popular I've suddenly become after being virtually anonymous for, like, you know, doing this for like 15 years and, you know, just having this sort of very small cult following. And now all of a sudden I'm all over the radio and, yeah, I've got three different talent agencies have contacted me telling me that their, clients, were interested in, acquiring the film rights. The first was the Gersh Agency. The second was CAA, Creative Artists Agency, I think. And the most recent one was the biggest of them all, the William Morris Endeavor Agency.
Holy moly.
The King of the Hill. And they actually had me come in for a face-to-face meeting with their client who was interested in acquiring the rights. Who turned out to be, of all people, Glenn Howerton from the FX TV series It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Have you ever seen that? Are you a fan at all?
No, no.
It's a real irreverent comedy on FX. It's been running for like 9 seasons. It was started by this guy and two buddies of his, you know, these three, sort of a buddy comedy sort of thing, and they've been doing it for 9 years now. Took on Danny DeVito in the second season, and got a lot more publicity and popularity from that point on. But Yeah, he's the one that had his agent have me come in just a few weeks ago, like 3 or 4 weeks ago. And,
it's kind of interesting. I mean, because a lot of the information has been on the website. And, in fact, you were sort of wondering, well, gosh, I mean, the stuff is already out there. And, of course, when you wrote the book, you fleshed things out and added new stuff. And it's been a big change, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, I was unsure how much of a market there was going to be for it, you know.
Exactly. Because, I remember you talking about,
I mean, it's been on the internet since 2008. You know, it started as an ongoing series and it ran through like 2012, 2013. So it was floating around for like 4 or 5 years and was cross-posted by various other people, you know, and even translated into other languages. There's a whole Russian language version of it floating around out there, believe it or not. And so, you know, it had been widely, widely circulated, you know, for several years. So, I was a little unsure how well it would be received as a book.
And, right.
It's been phenomenal. As of this morning, I think I have 95 or 96 reviews on Amazon, and like almost 70 of them are 5-star reviews, which is just, it's mind blowing to me that, in 5 months, it's already passed up all of my, I think it's passed all of my other books combined, actually.
Wow.
As far as, you know, and they've been bouncing around. Program to Kill's been on Amazon for 10 years. Understanding the F Word, I think, for 11 or 12 years. And Derailing Democracy for like 13 years.
Right.
And in all that time, the three of them combined have not gotten as much attention, as many reviews, and as many positive reviews as this one has gotten in just 5 months. So it's just, yeah.
Well,
it's been,
I think it's a period of time that so many people can relate to, and so many people want to know. Well, the title itself, "Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon," and I mean your title is enough to kind of sweep people into, well, what is this about? And I mean, you talk about the hippie dream. Those are all topics that people can still relate to. Now, once in a while, there might be something on TV where they have these older music people singing, and when they pan the audience, you can see all of these people. Young people are singing along, and just a big crowd of people. They had such a following that any book that talks about this is going to have that same kind of a following. Don't you think?
Yeah, it really does seem to resonate with a lot of people, and it's got incredible reach. I mean, it really seems to reach across, you know, gender lines, political affiliations, cultural lines, even national lines. I mean, I've been doing direct sales, you know, since it came out. I've been making bulk purchases from my publisher and selling signed copies through my website, of which I've already sold like over 500 copies, I think. There's like over 500 signed copies floating around out there in the last
Fabulous.
5 months. And I have sent them to I can't even remember where all they've gone. I mean, all the English-speaking world, a lot to Canada and the UK and Australia and New Zealand, you know, all over there, but also to France, to Germany, to Spain, to Colombia, to Austria,
wow.
Norway, Sweden, Switzerland. I mean, there's signed copies of my books all over the world now.
Wonderful!
It's so bizarre that to me that to know that it has that it reaches across so many lines.
Exactly. All right, Dave, we're going to be back in 3 minutes after a word from our sponsors. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest these last 2 hours is David McGowan. He is the author of this wonderful book, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. I love that title. We last talked on Spinkola Zone on Monday, April 21st, 2014, right before the book came out. And, and as soon as it did come out, I signed up, you know, to get it as soon as it came out. And, all the stuff that happened during the 60s. Oh my gosh. You talk about Charlie Manson and, I think of all the stuff that happened during the 60s. People
it was just an absolutely insane decade, really, and just infinitely fascinating to me. The first decade of my life, you know, having been born in 1960. And, I mean, just, you know, the whole countercultural, the whole explosion of the countercultural movement with all the new music and the hippies and the yippies and the flower children, and then you had... all the assassinations, you know, going on, JFK, RFK, MLK, Malcolm X, Fred Hampton, a pretty substantial list of leaders of both the black and white communities that were getting just kicked off left and right. And then you had the all the riots, you know, the inner cities exploding, Detroit and Los Angeles and various other places where, just massive civil unrest. And then you had the Apollo mission, you know,
right.
thrown into the mix, and then all that big diversion and distraction. And, it was just this big, huge jumble of just amazing stuff going on, you know, just this constant series of things going on. And, so that decade has always been of, great fascination to me, and it has become the topic of, you know, a lot of my writing, this and the lengthy Apollo series that I've done also.
Oh, absolutely, which was very nice, very good.
Yeah, it was a very wild and woolly decade, to say the least, you know, so much stuff going on, and so much of it intertwined, and so much of it, you know, happening right here in L.A., you know, the Laurel Canyon scene, obviously, the Watts riots, RFK was killed right here in the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. So, a lot of this was centered right here in my little hometown. So it's a decade and a period of time and set of circumstances that just fascinated me throughout my life.
Well, the reason I think, too, that is so popular outside of the country is because the things that happened during the 60s in the United States affected so many other countries. Because you're talking about, well, the Vietnam War, you're talking about so many other things.
How did I forget that one? The Vietnam War also going on throughout that period. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, all this stuff going on that affected other countries and our relationship to other countries. And, the assassination of a president, which turned, well, it reformatted the government. It reformatted the objectives. It did so many, it made so many changes. And then you also had all the legislation during the 60s, where you had, exemptions, the 501c3 exemptions, church exemptions, so people, the churches could no longer address certain things, and all of this stuff that went on. The immigration law was changed. You could write several books about this. You could probably take each of your chapters and write a book, and you'd be busy the rest of your life.
Yeah, absolutely, and I can't believe that I left the Vietnam War out of my list of major 60s events, because that was certainly one of the major ones that was, you know, always in the background throughout the 60s and into the 70s, and and the anti-war protests, of course, the flip side of that coin, and
exactly.
The shootings at Kent State, although I think that was actually 1970, we just left the decade of the 60s, but close enough. And yeah, I mean, there's just so much ground to be mined there throughout that decade. Yeah, you could write any number of books, without being repetitive. You could write just a whole bookcase full of books on all the craziness from that decade.
And it was deliberate. I've always been fascinated because of your justifiable claims that the music industry was full of intelligence operatives who were literally changing the perceptions of, the anti-war movement, and really changing things around, demonizing the anti-war movement. Go ahead, talk to us about that.
All the military connections that these people had, and the more you look at it, the less organic this whole thing looks, and the more contrived. And there's just way too many people lurking about the scene with these shadowy, career military and military intelligence connections. And since the book's come out, I've come across the cases of few very really interesting cases in the music world that I've been posting on the book's Facebook page. Some cases of people that really kind of illuminate just how close a relationship there is between the military intelligence complex and the music world. And one of those is a guy by the name of Jeff Skunk Baxter, who was a very accomplished musician. He played with Steely Dan and a couple of other bands, and as a session guitarist, very accomplished and very well-respected musician on the scene for many years, who then left the music world to become a national security consultant with a high-level security clearance.
Oh, that is different.
Which is what he does today, which is very odd, because, how do you just all of a sudden overnight make that transition? What training and preparation does a rock musician have for being a national, a recognized, respected, national security expert with a high-level security clearance, And then there's another case, this guy, I think his name was Philip Taylor Kramer, very similar. He was a well-respected rock musician. He played with Iron Butterfly in the post-Inagata Davida days, when they weren't really well-known, because that's really the only song and album that they were really known for. But he played with them, and then same thing. He left the music world and went into the national security, national defense business, and then disappeared under very suspicious circumstances, and his body wasn't recovered till quite a while afterwards, and it was ultimately written off as a suicide. But that was another very strange career arc of another guy who went directly from the rock music world into the national security world, just like seamlessly moved from one to the other. And then there was a third guy who was part of the Seattle grunge scene. He played with Nirvana and also with, I think, Soundgarden. And again, very well-respected, accomplished musician on the scene. And then he left the music world and became like a special forces assassin, basically carrying out hits for Uncle Sam. You have these three cases of people that just moved directly and seamlessly from the rock music world into the military world. With no indication that they had any prior training, but obviously they had to. They had to. So,
okay, we do need to take a quick break. We'll be back in 3 minutes. And our guest is David McGowan. He is the author of some wonderful books, including his latest one, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and The Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. It is available in Kindle or paperback at Amazon, and also from you. And your website is davesweb.cnchost.com. weirdscenes.com. And you have a Facebook page, facebook.com/weirdscenesinsidethecanyon. And you have a picture, two pictures of Phil Spector, now and then. Those pictures, he's had some work done, okay? His chin is in the older picture. You really can't, he looks older back than he does now.
I was just telling somebody else asked me about that on an interview just a couple days ago, and I was saying that prison's apparently been very good for Phil Spector, because he looks a whole lot better than he did the way he presented himself when he went to trial.
Yeah, you know, that's
it's
pretty
awesome. It's a vast improvement. I don't know what to make. And he looks much happier. I think prison's apparently been very good for Phil Spector, and it still just absolutely baffles me how anyone with their life, you know, their very life and liberty on the line, could have gone into that courtroom and presented himself to the jury and the courtroom and the American public in the manner in which he did, and not have realized how completely
ridiculous,
bizarre and ridiculous he looked. You know, it's just mind-boggling to me that he could have done that. You know,
and, this picture.
And now, yeah, he looks so much better now. You know, I mean, he looks so much more normal and natural, and it's a vast improvement, I must say.
Yeah, it's amazing. It is amazing. And your Facebook page, it just goes on and on. It's just wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. And up at the top, you have a timeline. Let's see. I love timelines, but it doesn't seem to want to come up. Or maybe it, I'm not sure. Okay. But
my Facebook army has been growing in leaps and bounds. Since the book came out, I had no Facebook presence at all until this book, and I've never been a fan of social media at all, and it was only under pressure from my publisher that I put up the page for the book, because he convinced me that in this day and age, and especially with a product that's not going to get any mainstream media support, that social media is really a key component of any good marketing strategy. So he had me put it up, and
I think that's really
catching on. I think 2,100 followers or something.
Sales 2,070.
Yeah, it's not like, you know, not like like Kim Kardashian levels or anything like that.
Thank goodness.
I mean,
what would you have
to do that? What's that?
Yeah, but think of what you'd have to do to get those levels. I mean,
yeah, I know. But,
you don't even want to compare yourself to those people.
Considering it's a fairly new page with pretty humble origins, it's doing fairly well. You know, again, just like the Amazon page really seems to be catching fire, and it's all very, very gratifying. You know, because I put so much time and effort into this thing, and as you know, I really didn't know how it was going to be received, and
sure.
So to see to see my growing Facebook following and the reviews piling up on Amazon is very, very gratifying and a little overwhelming at the same time.
Sure.
So,
well, as we were saying before, I remember you thought, well, why would I do that? Why would I write a book when this stuff has already been out there? I mean, why would I do that? And aren't you glad you did? Gosh, this is beautiful.
You know, a lot of the sales have been to people that followed the series that nevertheless, you know, wanted it, either to have in permanent form or
because
they were curious about the new material, because there is a lot of new material in there. And I'm picking up a lot of new readers, you know. I mean, you can definitely tell if you read through the Amazon reviews which are the longtime fans and which are the people that just discovered the book.
Right.
Yeah, there's a considerably different tone to the reviews. You know, some of the newbies really like it. You know, people that I'm reaching new people. And there's certainly some haters in the crowd, but, you know, that goes with the territory. I fully fully expected that, you know, going into this. So, you know, you got to roll with that. But, you know, there's always going to be the one-star people putting in their 2 cents. So, yeah.
Sure.
What are you gonna do?
Now, you mentioned Mick Jagger. Well, you mentioned a lot of people. The book is just fabulous. Fabulous. I mean,
yeah, there's so many names in it. I mean, it even amazes me how many names were connected and from how many different walks of life. You know, if you scroll through the index of the book, you see, big name rock stars, big name actors, up and coming politicians. A few serial killers in the mix.
Right. Yes.
A few porn stars, a few very well-known porn stars in the mix. John Holmes works his way into the narrative. Marilyn Chambers, Ron Jeremy, the future governor and lieutenant governor of the state of California, who we still have as a governor even now for some reason.
Oh, he's in there, too.
Can't seem to get rid of the guy. Jerry Brown, the guy just will not go away. It's unbelievable.
Yeah,
they
that's
were
true.
On the
it just won't go away.
I mean, it's just just this unbelievable brew of people, you know, these up-and-coming music stars, these up-and-coming actors, these up-and-coming politicians, these up-and-coming serial killers, these up-and-coming porn stars, all happily coexisting in this little slice of L.A. And, it's an infinitely fascinating story on so many levels, and which is, you know, why it's gotten the response that it did. And people that read this book are very, very passionate about it. Not always positively, but the vast majority of the responses I've gotten have been very positive, but, also some very, very negative ones. So it's a book that people, love it or hate it, people feel very, very passionately about it. So,
how could anybody hate it? I mean, you're giving some very good information. Why would anybody hate it?
Because we live in a ridiculously celebrity-obsessed and celebrity-driven culture, and people are very, very reluctant to give up their icons, you know? These are very iconic figures, you know, even to this day, 50 years after the fact. These are still household names and people that you can, you know, turn on a classic rock station and hear their music playing daily, you know, people like Jim Morrison, David Crosby, and Frank Zappa. I mean, you know, these are like larger than life figures and, that people have held up on a pedestal for decades. And it's difficult to let that go or, you know, even partly. The book generates very strong reactions from people. So, but that's good, right? I mean, it starts discussions and, you know, it's a little bit polarizing, but I think that's probably a good thing. So,
right.
I don't know. I'm very proud of it.
what do your kids think about it?
Despite the occasional one-star reviews, I'm very proud of the effort and the finished product that came out of it and, you know, the work that the publisher did as far as, you know, the title and the cover design and the whole packaging of the book,
good.
I think they did, you know, I mean, the content of the book I can take credit for, but the packaging, that really belongs to them. And I think they did a phenomenal job with it and it really captures the tone and the mood of the book, you know, just really, really well. I think they did the whole package, I couldn't really be happier with it.
Right. Let's see, chapter 18, you talk about the mamas and the papas, and that's very interesting. I mean, and you're talking about ritually butchered body was nude. And this was the mutilated body of aspiring actress Elizabeth Short.
The notorious Black Dahlia murder, which had indirect connections to the scene through the fact that one of the prime suspects at the time, and this was a very, very notorious murder, very well known in L.A. and to some extent outside of L.A. It happened in, I think, 1947. And it involved this young actress who was murdered and cut in half
We're going to be back in 3 minutes. We'll digest that, and we'll be back in 3 minutes. Deanna, and I'm talking to David McGowan. He is the author of his latest book, and that is Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. And we're talking about the Black Dahlia, and you give this background, and I mean, these people are so, their backgrounds are so intriguing. I mean, my parents just, they grew up, they got married, they had kids, so, you know, and you're talking about people who worked at this air base and that air base, and they had, they were, the backgrounds, it's just amazing. How could you have all that stuff going on in your background and turn out normal? Well, I guess they didn't, did they?
Yeah, there you go. There's just so many crazy connections and so many just sensational high-profile murders that were, directly connected to that scene, or directly or indirectly, I should say, connected to that scene. The Manson murders, of course, were directly connected, and as were the Wonderland murders, were probably the two most high-profile, most brutal mass murders in the city's history, both involving five victims, and both with very direct connections to the Laurel Canyon scene. And then, what surprised me, perhaps even more, was that there was this indirect connection to the Black Dahlia murder, which had occurred some two decades earlier in 1947. And as I started to say, it involved this very, very, I mean, especially for the time, we're talking 1947 here, this was a much more innocent era, and this young gal, aspiring actress, was found posed in a field, literally cut in half with the two parts of her body posed. Just a very, very gruesome, brutal scene, especially for that time. And one of the prime suspects then and now was a guy by the name of Dr. George Hodel, who was a very high society physician, and accused by his own son, a former LAPD officer, has repeatedly accused his own father of being the Black Dahlia killer. But several years after the Black Dahlia killing, Dr. Hodel faced trial on very, very serious and very sensational charges that he had not only molested his own daughter, Tamar, but had passed her around at parties to his elite Hollywood friends, including like film director John Huston. Just very sordid, decadent behavior, to say the least, and all kinds of sensational allegations and charges flew around that trial. And the gal, Tamar Hodel, the daughter who had accused the father, she later became the surrogate mother of none other than Michelle Phillips, of the Mamas and the Papas. Her own natural mother had died when she was very young, and she'd been being raised by a single father. And this Tamar Hodel stepped in from a fairly early age and sort of served as the surrogate mother for Michelle Phillips. And, she considered her sort of like her mother for the rest of her life. And so she was very close to Michelle and John Phillips, so thereby providing this very strange, indirect connection to the Black Dahlia murder. And then, to further sort of muddy up that story, make it just a little sleazier, then you have John Phillips' own daughter, Mackenzie, later accusing her father of the very same thing, basically, of molesting her and impregnating her, which is what Tamar Hodel had accused her father of, that he had impregnated her and then forced her to have an abortion. And then you have You know, and then she becomes the surrogate mother of Michelle Phillips, who marries John, and then John's later accused of the very same behavior from his own daughter. So it's just, it's a very, very, I mean, the backgrounds, the family stories of these people are just beyond bizarre at times.
Indeed. My gosh. My goodness. My goodness.
I just found out, even more recently, I just found out within the last week, actually, that that one of Beach Boy Dennis Wilson's wives, this gal by the name of Karen Lamb, who he actually married twice. He married once in 1976, and it didn't last very long, and then he remarried her again in 78, which again didn't last too long. But anyway, he married her twice, and then like some 10 years later, she just happened to become a good friend of a gal by the name of Kitty Menendez, who, as you probably know, shortly thereafter got shotgunned to death along with her husband.
By their sons,
perpetrated by the two sons, Lyle and Eric. So there you have another weird indirect line leading from Laurel Canyon to the Menendez murders. So, I mean, you got all of these ridiculously high-profile, sensational murders. You know, the Manson murders and the Wonderland murders directly connected, and the Black Dahlia and Menendez murders indirectly connected to that scene. And, yeah, it's mind-boggling how many violent deaths can be directly or indirectly traced to that scene.
Wow. And then people just died, like Cass Elliott. Didn't she just die? I can't remember the circumstances. I heard she choked on a ham sandwich or something.
That was what it was initially claimed, and a lot of people still believe that. In some accounts, it's still printed. You know, some printed accounts still make that claim, but officially, the official cause of death, according to the autopsy and death certificate, was massive heart failure or something like that, due to her, obesity or something. It was a more natural cause, supposedly, but of course,
more
acceptable cause. Yeah, but there's been much speculation that it actually wasn't either one of those, you know, and that she just had too many connections to too many things that had gone on in that era. And, people that were closely connected to Manson prior to the murders tended to meet with unfortunate ends, you know, Dennis Wilson being another one, you know, that was close to Manson who died under questionable circumstances as well. So,
he's dead. Okay.
Yeah, there's definitely questions about Mama Cass's death, but the public perception has long been that she choked on a ham sandwich. The official version, I believe, was heart failure. But wow. I don't know that I buy either one of them, really. So,
wow. Well, the Beach Boys. When you think of the Beach Boys, you think of, clean white sand and just wonderful, these kids just singing but when you look into, their background, when you look into, some of their behaviors and activities, it's all different.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, they really didn't seem to fit into the scene, you know? I mean, here were these five kids, very, very clean cut, short haired, wearing like matching uniforms and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, they did not look like the other bands milling about Laurel Canyon, you know, who were growing their hair out and mustaches and beards and wearing beads and hippie duds and whatnot, you know, and here's the Beach Boys in their, you know, matching Hawaiian shirts with matching haircuts and, you know, they couldn't have had a more clean cut, squeaky clean. I mean, they got invited to play at the White House, and I mean, they always had that all American clean cut, image. But yeah, the reality behind the scenes just couldn't have been any different. They were doing all the same stuff that all of the other people were doing. They just didn't so much look the part. You know?
Wow. Well, Manson. He was an evil is an evil monster.
I mean, he's still very much in the public mind. You know, he's sort of that all-purpose boogeyman. Well, I mean, he's for many years now. He's been number one. You know, and in name recognition, I would think among famous serial killers or spree killers or whatnot.
Sure. Okay, we're at the top of the hour. We will be back at 6 minutes after the hour. So stay with us, and we will take your phone calls at 800-313-9443.
Tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is David McGowan. His latest book is Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. It is available in Kindle or paperback at Amazon and also at Dave's site, which is davesweb.cnchost.com. And I just did a search in the book on, and that's why I love Kindle books. You can do searches on various words and terms. On LSD, and there's 21, it's mentioned 21 times. And because the CIA and the psychiatric industry were very much into LSD, and apparently so were a lot of other people. And it's kind of interesting how the CIA had it, and psychiatric industry had it, and a lot of the former presidents of the American Psychiatric Association were testing it. And I'm wondering if they maybe just did a little civilian test on certain groups here in California, or there in California.
I believe they did some massive test, actually. You know, I mean, to this day, I find it very highly unusual that that much more benign, so to speak, drugs like marijuana carried fairly stiff penalties back then that were pretty rigorously enforced in most cases. You know, there's stories of this one musician profiled in the book, Roki Erickson, got like sentenced to a long term in like a mental institution for like, you know, possession of a couple of joints or something ridiculous like that. It was just unbelievable, and yet LSD remained perfectly legal up through I think like 1967 or something, wasn't it, before it was before they passed any legislation criminalizing LSD. It was completely legal, you know, and LSD, as I'm sure some of your listeners know, is an incredibly powerful drug, just amazingly powerful, just a tiny, tiny, tiny dose, you know. It's amazing, you know, what just a single drop of this, you know, could do, or, you know, a fairly small quantity, you know, to an area's water supply or something like that. Just an amazingly powerful drug to be let loose, you know, perfectly legal, and it was freely available at, you know, all the big events, you know, Woodstock and like the Monterey Pop Festival and the notorious Altamont concert and like the Human Being. There were like tens of thousands of hits being handed out, all mostly cooked up by this one chemist by the name of Owsley, who himself, you know, had extensive government and intelligence connections. And he would cook up just these massive batches of it, and it would be freely handed out at big concerts and big gatherings, which is just amazing. I mean, you would never see that happen nowadays. Somebody was obviously financing all of that. It'd be like flying a helicopter over a crowd now and, like tossing buckets full of $20 bills out or something, I mean, it's not the kind of thing that ever happened other than that, in that era. And, the standard spin is that we're supposed to believe that, these people were very altruistic and had nothing but noble intentions, and that, their mission was to turn on the world, because they thought that was a good thing and a positive thing. And I don't know that I fully believe that. I find it very hard to believe that it's just sheer coincidence that it remained not only legal but freely available to pretty much anyone that wanted it. It's an amazingly powerful drug to be treated in that way throughout the better part of the 60s.
Wow. Well, of course, the CIA and the military were developing it and using it. So, and if the music industry had associations with the intelligence industry, then obviously something was certainly going on. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. And it wasn't just LSD; it was other DMT, STP, these even more exotic hallucinogens that were being created back then, and all of which were just direct outgrowth of military research and intelligence research, MK Ultra research, and chemical warfare agents and whatnot. They were all outgrowths of the military intelligence establishment, and that just happened to find their way into the the hippie communities.
Sure.
Strangely enough. So and a lot of people want to believe that was a good thing. I mean, there's a lot of opinions on it. It's generally recognized by a lot of people that LSD and all the affiliated hallucinogens began life as military products, research products. But there's debate about whether it was deliberately introduced into the population or whether it just sort of leaked into the population. And then there's debate about if it was deliberately leaked, was it an effective strategy, or was it one that backfired on the military intelligence community? So, there's a broad range of opinion on that. I think it was deliberately introduced and that it was actually pretty effective. But
sure.
That seems to be kind of a minority opinion, but that's the way I pretty much view it.
Sure. And there were all these flower children, and they were taking drugs and engaging in sex and getting rid of their bras and doing, I mean, it was free, and everybody was doing anything they wanted to do. And of course they link this to the anti-war movement, which totally discredited it.
Yeah, they put the most unattractive face on the anti-war movement that they could come up with. It seems like, short of like putting, someone, the face of like some alien invader or something, they might as well have, because all of a sudden you had these long-haired, bearded, hippies spouting these slogans and listening to this music and preaching, free love and open drug use and, inventing their own lingo, their own code words and, hips and squares and cool and far out and all this stuff that we do, some of which we still use to this day,
Sure.
So it was really, it was, yeah, I mean, it was, it's, it was, you know, I mean, to mainstream America, these were just, you know, dirty, unshaven, you know, unhygienic weirdos that were, you know, preaching all these crazy ideas mixed in with the anti-war message. And I think it was a very effective strategy for marginalizing and diluting that message.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Now, Manson had some association with Haight Ashbury in San Francisco, correct? Didn't he kind
of? Yeah, he did. He traveled up there. He's even blamed, you know, some people have tried to link him to some murders up there, actually, and you know, tried to say there was overlap between the Manson and the Zodiac murders. Some theorists have claimed that. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but he certainly did spend time in the area up there on the Haight, yeah.
Wow.
He got around, yeah. Old Charlie did.
I can't believe he's still alive.
I know. And you see pictures of him now and then, you know. He's definitely aged over the years. And,
yeah.
I don't know how old he is, but he's still hanging on.
Wow. All righty, we're going for a 3-minute break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest is David McGowan. His latest book is Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. It is available in Kindle or paperback at Amazon. And his website is davesweb.cnchost.com. And his Facebook page is facebook.com/Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon. And Manson is 79 years old. I guess Supreme Court changed the law for that, and so they didn't believe in capital punishment. And he had an association with Terry Melcher and with David Crosby and Neil Young and Brian Wilson and gosh.
Yeah, he was much more tightly integrated into the scene than a lot of people want to talk about, and had been accepted as a peer, and had been, you know, promoted by various artists who had, you know, championed him to their record labels in attempts to get him signed, Neil Young being one of them, one of his biggest fans, and Dennis Wilson as well. And the Beach Boys had toured with Buffalo Springfield, so Wilson had gotten close with Young and Stephen Stills and whatnot, and then the summer right after that is the summer that Manson and various members of his entourage spent the entire summer housed at Wilson's home, and so through Wilson he met quite a few of the Laurel Canyon people, and some of them were big admirers, you know, until the murders, and then, you know, everybody couldn't distance themselves fast enough from him.
Right.
Mama Cass and John Phillips, both very close also. So close, in fact, that they were initially listed on the witness list for the trial. They were at one time scheduled to be called as witnesses at the Manson murder trials, and managed to avoid getting called and managed to avoid getting really any publicity over the fact that they were supposed to be called. So, you know, a lot of that's long forgotten now, but, back at the time he was kind of, viewed as a peer and as a promising, singer-songwriter that, you know, had a career ahead of him. The Manson story could have gone a much different direction, you know?
Sure.
A much, much different direction than the one it did. And 79 years old and still alive, and he's been in prison for Well, it just continuously now for 45 years, but even before that, he had spent the majority of his life in prison, you know, even during his years as a minor. A lot of it had been spent in juvenile facilities. So I think the guy's like almost 80, and he's probably had like 10 or 15 years of freedom in his entire life, you know, including his childhood. Pretty amazing that he's still alive and kicking, actually.
True. Now, he's got three kids.
Does he?
Yeah.
Charles Miles, go ahead. I'm sure he has more than that unofficially, because I'm sure he does. He pretty much had every woman in his little commune there at his command. So, who knows how many kids he could have fathered.
He could have a dozen or two dozen for all we know.
He could have a whole bunch, yeah. He could have a whole army of them, you know. It's hard to say.
Now, I think everybody's always been fascinated with the Sharon Tate murder and that four other people died. And why do people do that? I don't know. How can you attach a motive to something so horrific?
Well, I mean, of course, the official motive, it was the helter-skelter motive that was, what was argued in court and what was presented in the book Helter Skelter, which is what most people, most people's go-to source on the Manson case is the original book written by the prosecuting attorney, Vincent Bugliosi. And it was argued in there that the purpose was supposedly to spur on a race war. You try to get white America to blame the murders on black America, I believe, and then ignite a race war. And then supposedly Charlie's troops were going to go into hiding, you know, out in their desert compound and ride this apocalyptic civil war out, and then they would sort of rise from the ashes to be the new rulers of what was left behind. That was what was argued in court and in the book. And, you know, other people since then have put forth other theories that it was drug related or, I don't know, there's various other, there's been a lot of speculation about
sure.
it. It was a very, very sensational crime, and you know, to this day people are just infinitely fascinated with Charles Manson, and there's been no shortage of books, you know, written about him. And people just can't get enough Charlie Manson, you know. So
right. We do have a caller. Let's take a phone call. Let's take Jeff in Idaho. Jeff?
Hi, Deanna.
Hi.
Hey, the previous owner of the place where the helter-skelter killing went down, I think they were a banker or someone associated in the music industry. Did you ever understand that banker or someone was someone who turned Manson down for his playing ability?
That's one of the theories. The owner of the home, I believe, was Rudy Altobelli.
Right.
I think it was.
Right.
And the previous tenant was that had moved out before Polanski and Tate moved in was Terry Melcher. And,
really?
It has been theorized by people that the murders were motivated by a rejection
right.
of a recording contract for Charlie by either. I've heard both. I've heard some people say that it was Altobelli that turned him down, and other people say that it was Melcher that turned him down, and that either way, he mistakenly thought that one of the two of them were living there, and so basically the Tate and her friends were sort of unintentional victims.
Right.
That's another theory that has been floated out there for a number of years now.
I think that was on lamestream media about an interview where someone said that he'd gotten dropped off in front of that location, and they talked about it. Uh, uh, and they admitted that as much, you know, for whatever that's worth. I just thought I'd add that.
That's definitely one of the that's one of the competing scenarios that's been put out there that it was kind
music,
of a
music mischief and military intelligence. Thanks, Ia.
Yeah, amazing.
Okay.
And the people that were there, I mean, what Sharon Tate was 8.5 months pregnant. She's married to Roman Polanski. And her friend and former lover, Jay Sebring, was there with, I mean, it's just this.
Yeah, I mean, that is bizarre. I mean, and supposedly, according to most accounts, the official story, when the Manson people first entered the home, Sharon Tate was in her bedroom in her sleepwear. And Jay Sebring was in the bedroom with her, sitting on the bed, talking to her, you know? And
yikes.
That seems kind of weird, you know? Would most husbands be comfortable with a former lover sitting on the bed with their, you know?
I think not. All righty, we're going for a three-minute break. We'll be right back, and we'll take some phone calls, 800-313-9443. Our guest is David McGowan. His latest book is a wonderful book. You need to purchase it. It is entitled Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and The Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. It is available in Kindle or paperback at Amazon, as well as at Dave's website, which is davesweb.cnchost.com. And his Facebook is facebook.com, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon. And we have some more callers. Let's take Chris in Las Vegas. Chris, welcome.
Well, hello there, Dave and Deanna.
Hi.
Hi.
What an interesting guest you've got there with Dave today. I had read some pretty interesting factoids related to that area, being a child of the 60s, if you will, and discovered that the CIA, Sandoz Labs, Owsley, LSD, and drug distribution network of the CIA in that particular area of the world had a pretty strong connection to the McMartin preschool cover-up there in the Valley area. And then it also had connections through Manson and his family to the Petaluma Polyclast case. And some of the darker sides of the satanic practices that preeminated throughout that particular cult, if you will.
Wow. Dave, any comment?
I don't know a whole lot about the polyclast, however it's pronounced. I mean, I'm aware of it, but I have not really looked into that. I'm not familiar really with any of the minutiae, any of the details of that. I am familiar with the McMartin case, which wasn't far from where I grew up, actually. I was born and raised in Torrance, which is one of the beach cities bordering on Manhattan Beach down there. And so I was definitely quite familiar with the McMartin case and well aware of the cover-up that went on there. But I was not aware of connections through, did you say it was through Manson or through Owsley to the McMartin case?
Well, I think it was through Manson's family or an extension thereof. I think I read it in the CIA Mind Control Ops, Special Ops or something, a book of that sort of title. I don't remember specifically, but I do know that there are still the similar forces at play. I've shared with Deanna before that I have a case in Utah, Salt Lake City area that I know of particularly, were very similar to the same McMartin sort of tactics, were involved in a allegedly Christian school where people had paid to take their children. They were being abducted during school hours and preyed upon sexually and gang raped and so on and so forth. Very young children. It's very terrifying and diabolical, but there seems to be such strong Zionist influences inside the FBI that it's very difficult to get any traction to investigate something like that.
Nice.
I have looked into quite a bit various multi-perpetrator, multi-victim, child molestation, pedophilia cases, child pornography, child prostitution, whatnot. I haven't lately. It was a very, very dark subject matter, to say the least, and I delved quite deeply into it about, 10, 12 years ago, and actually became the a major portion of my previous book, Program to Kill, which covers the McMartin case and the Presidio preschool case up in San Francisco involving mm-hmm. Michael Aquino, and the Finders case and the Country Walk case and a few other very, very high-profile cases that had occurred up until that point. So I'm very familiar with that ground, but not so much with more recent cases.
I'm wondering if you also may see some parallels or at least strong similarities to some of these apparent lone wolf shootings that are likely Manchurian or psychotropic drug created lone wolf drones sent out by some of the covert ops of the darker intel side that seem to be involved in some of these Aurora, Columbine, Tucson,
absolutely.
So on and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. My previous book also covered serial killer cases, and was sort of an alternative look at serial killer cases as sort of programmed assassins and a means of creating fear among the people and justifying, overt, police state tactics. And the funny thing is that since that book has been written, serial killers have become a much less noticeable phenomenon than they used to be. In the 70s, before the 70s, we didn't even have a term for it. The behavioral sciences units of the FBI rolled out the term serial killer in the early 70s to explain this this sudden phenomenon that seemed to be going on, where all of a sudden we had all of these big-name, larger-than-life serial killers like Ted Bundy and Charles Manson and the Hillside Stranglers and John Wayne Gacy.
Richard Ramirez.
Richard Nightstalker and the Hillside Stranglers and... all these celebrity level serial killers that we had for 20 years, and now that seems to have largely died out. And it's hard to remember the last time we had a name brand serial killer like that, to scare the daylights out of the American people. And the reason is that they don't need them anymore, because they've been replaced by these spree killers, / homegrown terrorists that blow up the Boston Marathon or shoot up a movie theater or a school, and they serve the same purpose now that the serial killers used to serve. And and nobody ever questioned. I won't say nobody, but the vast majority of the people just accept that, just as they accepted in the 70s that now all of a sudden serial killers are now a part of your daily life, whereas they didn't used to be, but now all of a sudden they are. And people just accepted that, and now they've accepted that, serial killers have been kind of pushed into the background, and now we have, these very high-profile spree killings and whatnot. And that's accepted now as perfectly normal and natural. And it's quite remarkable, really, that they're able to consistently pull that off. And, it's just all a continuation of the same phenomenon, in my mind.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's time for a sequel to your Program to Kill book to update us on
people tell me that all the time. You gotta do a sequel and cover, Columbine and Aurora and Sandy Hook and, on and on and on and on. And, there's certainly a book to be written there. There's no question about it. It would be a fascinating work. Who knows? I don't know. Maybe I'll do it. We'll see,
Deanna,
if time allows.
Thank you for having such an interesting guest on today. Thank you, David.
All righty.
Thank you,
Chris. All righty. Let's take Kent in West Virginia. Kent, welcome.
Yeah. Hi, Deanna.
Hi.
Well, first thing, Dave, you want to be very careful about if you're going to do research into the pedophilia aspect. You remember you're into music, Pete Townsend, who got supposedly was just doing research, but they arrested him and were going to charge him, and then he said he was just doing. You remember that case, I'm sure. Right?
Yeah, that's a very effective means of silencing and discrediting people. Yeah, is to link them to the very thing that they are working to expose, so to speak.
I don't know whether, of course, you know, they supposedly he was anyway. Well, you know, but in the light of what's become known in England in recent months, you know, about the pedophilia, maybe he wasn't, you know, it. Maybe it wasn't as innocent. Who knows? Anyway, but the idea that the CIA would be trying to use cultural means to create impressions really is like when I lived in Europe several decades ago, and I remember hearing about some guy had died and he had been like with the Voice of America or something, or and he had like the world's biggest collection of jazz music. And And apparently what the Voice of America was playing all of this jazz music around the world, portraying this image of America as a free society, you know, jazz music. And I knew at the time that, you know, in the 50s and 60s that mainstream America, you know, really did not like jazz, and it was portraying an image of America really that did not fit the mainstream. And then I found out that they were clandestinely through these foundations and everything. They were supporting all of these, what some people call modern art. This is really, I think, is garbage. And they were shipping them over, you know, and all of these artists that were supposedly sort of countercultural and really even in their own minds thought they were being un-American or at least anti-establishment. They were being supported by the establishment.
Gentlemen, we're going to a quick break. We'll be right back. You can stay over. We'll be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest is David McGowan. He wrote Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. It is available in Kindle or paperback at Amazon. And Kent did stay over. Kent, would you like to finish your thought, your question?
Yeah, and then, of course, we've, I believe we know now that Gloria Steinem, who was this...
Joya.
And she was supposedly a CIA operative. One of her incarnations. And so So when you think about the counterculture, like I grew up in that time and remember all the music, anti-war and anti-establishment music that was coming out of establishment radio stations, and it did kind of cross my mind, isn't that odd, you know, that there's no censorship, and of course maybe it's all controlled and it's just an image that they're creating for us to give us something to latch on to that's something, a step back from something more serious. So yeah, I mean, it's not impossible that all these people were being influenced, or, you know, some of them were, some of them weren't, you know, but, you know, the government, the CIA certainly is manipulating all of our perceptions of America and that sort of thing. So it's pretty disturbing, you know, demoralizing, really, as far as I'm concerned.
Sure. Your thoughts, Dave?
He had talked before the break about funding and influencing of the fine arts, so to speak, and I've heard that and seen some evidence of that the CIA did in fact fund the fine arts, so to speak, with the express purpose of corrupting them, and in particular people like Jackson Pollock. I've heard quite a bit of talk about him being funded, and his quote unquote paintings look an awful lot like the drop cloth that I use at work, to be honest with you. And You know, a lot of modern art I really just do not understand at all. Maybe I'm just uncultured, but there does seem to have been a degradation in the art in general, you know, and not, you know, not just in the music and acting professions, but, you know, in the fine arts, so to speak. And a lot of what passes for modern art these days, I just don't get it at all. So I don't find that hard to believe that they have their hands pretty much everywhere, and influence, everything that we perceive in our lives, basically. Our reality is very much shaped and molded.
Exactly. Well, Ken, thank you so much for your phone call. Always appreciate hearing from you. Let's take Reese real quick in New York. Reese?
Hey, do I have the great Dave McGowan out there?
Yep.
Well, the one and only. You have the Dave McGowan.
Well, Dave, you're given new meaning to being hip and cool in the modern age. And to me, that means you're shining the light of truth on what really went on with that generation. I ordered two of your books, both are signed copies, and I gave one to my mom because she's from that generation. I got a couple of questions for you. All right.
Okay.
You brought out very well the fact that most of these musicians, the big names like Jim Morrison, Crosby, the Wilson Brothers, I got to add Bob Dylan into that, most of them couldn't sing or play, and certainly they could not compose music. So here's what I'm wondering. Did they get a little help from their friends, and did that help come from the Lookout Observatory? Do you think there's a possibility there, or did it come from another direction?
It came from somewhere, you know. Jim Morrison, you know, how he came up with all these songs is really just an absolute mystery to me. And some of the others as well. Anything that I could come up with would just be pure speculation, you know. I mean, I don't have any hard and fast evidence other than just, you know, sort of the. Mm-hmm. There has to be somewhere that this came from. And the fact that all of these people all simultaneously just sort of started writing, this very same music. They all started writing and working in this folk rock, mode just like out of nowhere. And, it talks about in the book how the mamas and the papas were very far removed from the scene when they wrote their first album. They were down in like the Caribbean, and yet they arrived in LA with this fully composed album that just happened to have the very same sound that everybody else was coming up with. So it's all very strange how all these songs really came about. Mm-hmm. and how all of these artists just happened to find themselves gathered in the same place, writing the same kind of all new, you know, never heard before music. And,
all of a sudden there's this genius coming out of them where before they sounded like a garage band. And by the way, I find the same thing with the Beatles. If you listen to the Beatles' earlier recordings just before their big debut in 1964 on Ed Sullivan, you could listen to these recordings and videos on YouTube. I mean, they sounded like a typical garage band. They didn't have these sounds that they came out with suddenly in 1964 to 67. So apparently, as their song goes, they got a little help from their friends somewhere, and no one has been able to really say who it was. You know, some people are saying it came out of Tavistock, but of course they've kept the lid on it. I read the book, by the way, by Alistair Taylor, who was the Beatles, basically their roadie. He was the assistant to Brian Epstein. And I'm going to tell you something, Dave. It wasn't what he wrote in that book. It's what he didn't write. Reading some of the accounts, I could tell he was withholding information that he knew he could not reveal in that book. So apparently somebody is keeping a very tight lid on the hidden hand behind the scenes of that era.
Wow. Yeah, well, there was certainly, a lot of that music was created in the studio and couldn't really be duplicated, on the stage, certainly not by the musicians who were, you know, pictured on the album covers anyway. The Beatles actually stopped touring in like 1967, you know, I mean, like the height of their, their popularity and really just became, you know, a studio band after that. And, you know, the most likely explanation for that is because their music had become much more complicated from, like, Sgt. Pepper's on. You know, they had moved from the, you know, She Loves You, Yeah, 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 to these much more intricately textured songs. And I believe that they didn't have the musical chops to perform those songs on stage, so they just stopped touring, you know. So there was a big difference, a wide gap between what was put out on records in those days and what you would actually hear if you went to a live performance, you know, which is why they used a lot of distraction techniques with the Freaks and the Young Turks and all of that, as it goes into in the book. So, yeah, that's, I guess, the best answer I can give you to that, since I think we've run out of time here.
Yep, we're just about out of time. We have 1 minute, and I'm sorry we won't be able to take the last caller, Kathy. Sorry, but we are out of time. Dave, thank you so much for being on the program. Gosh,
well,
it's just
thank you for having me. I always appreciate the opportunity, and you know, trying to get this book out to as many people as I can. So
exactly. Yes, it's a wonderful book,
yeah.
And I think everybody should own it and read it and find out what went on.
What's Amazon getting for the Kindle version nowadays? They've changed the price on it so many times, I can't keep up.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Gosh, I don't know, because I bought mine right after it came out. I'd have to look that up. I don't know what they're getting.
When it first came out, it was like $10, I think, which people told me was a good deal. And then it started creeping up, and for a while it was only like a dollar or two less than the paperback version. I'm thinking, why would you just not buy the paperback version? But then it went back down again.
Uh-huh.
I think their publisher
is probably in charge of doing the price, you know, working with the price.
Yeah, I don't know how that works. I have no idea. They changed the price on the paperback a lot too, for some reason.
Weird.
So, yeah, I don't know why. It'll just change now and then. Sometimes just by like a few cents. Like a few pennies. It's really strange.
Yes.
But anyway,
thank you so much
for having me, and we'll talk again.
Absolutely. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye, listeners. Take care. Thank you for joining us today. Bye-bye.